Bonjour. Bonsoir. Ni hao ma. Konnichiwa. Now, I know there are other languages here that I have not greeted you in. We need to know that we're all here together, so I would ask you, if there is a language I have not greeted you in, will you call out that greeting now?
Arabic, Ahlan wa sahlan. Russian, Dobro dan.
Greek, Danzig.
Wait. Italian, ciao. Portuguese, hola.
And in ASL? I think there may be not deaf people here because there is not an interpreter. I thank you for welcoming me here and my struggle in my life to get here. I want to tell you something personal about me. I've traveled here from Jersey City. I've been very ill since last summer. This is the first time I've been out of my house traveling. Thank you. While it's not life-threatening, something I didn't know last summer, it is a challenge for me physically to stand up here and speak. But I want you to know that what I lack in energy, I feel such a passion to be here, and I thank you so much for all the warmth that people have expressed to me since the moment I arrived. I want to know more about you, though. And so, without putting anyone on the spot, and out of respect and solidarity for disabled activists who are here, rather than ask people to stand, I'm going to ask you to raise your hands. Raise your hand, please, if you face oppression as a woman. Raise your hand, please, if you face oppression because you are transsexual, transgender, intersex, lesbian, gay, or bisexual.
Do they count?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they count. If you're a partner, not just related to oppression, but living with it as queer family, please raise your hand. If you face discrimination for femininity, whether female or male, please raise your hand. If you are oppressed because of your nationality, your ethnicity, your religion, or your immigration status, and you feel comfortable on that last one to raise your hand, please do. If you face inaccessibility in society based on age discrimination, whether youth or elder, please raise your hand. Now, if you've raised your hand more than once, please raise your hand. I believe that the movement for women's liberation will be more powerful as we explore more deeply the connections between all of us who raised our hands tonight. And together with all of those who are listening to these broadcasts, who we know would be raising their hands if they were here, and with those who are struggling around the world, from Iraq to Haiti, from Palestine to Venezuela. I thank Women's Studies at SFU for letting me be part of this conference today, this exciting conference today, and congratulations on the 30th anniversary of Women's Studies. It's a big, big thing to celebrate. It's also a big thing for me to get to come to Canada. I have spent a lot of my life in Canada. I grew up in Buffalo. I could have walked across the so-called Peace Bridge. It was so close. And for the old gay community, which I don't just mean those of us who are getting hoary-headed here, but the pre-Stonewall community, the blue-collar, gay, lesbian, drag communities, we were sororal communities with those from St. Catharines and Toronto and spent a great deal of our time in Canada. It was only during the Vietnam War when my gender queerness made crossing the bridge impossible, because when I would the first thing I would be asked is, where's your draft card? I was in Manitoba as a guest of the Two-Spirit Conference out in the woods under the rolling northern lights. In Quebec, as part of the anti-war and anti-globalization struggles. In Edmonton, and to where the prairies go from flat to beginning to roll up towards the Rocky Mountains. But until I flew over the volcanic ridge yesterday and saw the sun red on the mountains and sat down beside the Pacific, I have never been in Vancouver before. And thank you for inviting me here to learn from your conference, from your movement, from your struggles here, and their lessons that I'll take back to me, with me. While there is no universal military draft yet in the U.S., just an economic draft at this point, and extended tours that get extended and extended, my travel here across this border and returning home tomorrow through immigration in Chicago makes me a criminal. I'm a felon because this passport is issued to me as male, and I am female-bodied. I can talk more with you during the discussion about why, but I want to say to you that if I am detained in that no man's land of U.S. Customs, and it is a no man's land, then I ask you to help me make a struggle out of this, because I say to the U.S. government, come and get me. Let's make a political struggle out of this and tell me why, on a passport that has the most sophisticated form of identification possible, a recent photo, I have to check off an either or box and be virtually strip searched by customs just to come here and connect with you. I live in Jersey City on the East Coast across from Manhattan in the U.S. I don't use America because in the U.S. it's such a chauvinist term, because the assumption is that everyone in this hemisphere is not of the Americas, only those in the U.S. And tonight I want to focus on a couple of the historical lessons that we've had in the women's struggles in the U.S., not because of unexamined national chauvinism, but because I live in the belly of the beast. A beast making war domestically and carrying it around the world. My job is to bring the war home, to deepen understanding that my enemy is not in Baghdad or Gaza, Havana or Tehran, Damascus or Pyongyang or Caracas. It's in Washington, on Capitol Hill, and on Wall Street. And so it means a great deal to me here to be able to connect with you all about deepening our theoretical understanding of women's oppression and what it will take for liberation. Because if theory, I believe, is abstracted, if it is not a distillation of experience, then it ceases to become a guide for action. And the point, of course, of any studies, including women's studies, is not just to interpret the world, but to change it. The experience in the U.S. of the struggle for women's liberation, of course, predates what we call second wave feminism. There are many who have explored, perhaps not enough in the U.S., but have explored the relationship between the 19th century women's rights movement and the struggle to abolish the enslavement of African peoples. It was one of the greatest coalitions, if not the greatest, to date on the continent of what is now, in the country of what is now the United States. I believe we also need to explore the trans issues and gay issues that were part of that movement. To go back and restudy Sojourner Truth's challenge in her Ain't I a Woman speech, where she challenged white supremacy and the class bias of the social definition of what it meant to be a true woman, true womanhood. Sojourner Truth, who stood 6 feet tall, whose voice was described as rolling thunder, whose muscles rippled from a lifetime of enforced enslaved labor. Sojourner Truth, who was forced to strip to the waist by white men who demanded to know if she was a man in women's clothing. In Seneca Falls, the convention in 1848, Frederick Douglass, the great orator, the great abolitionist, and one of the greatest advocates for women's rights that we have seen yet in the United States, was one of 31 men who attended that convention. He stood up and said something there that we could march under as a banner today. He said from the podium that our doctrine is that right is of no sex. Frederick Douglass, the other 30 men at that convention, and any man who stood up for women's rights were gay baited and trans baited and intersexual baited. He was called a hermaphrodite, an Aunt Nancy's man, a women's rights man. Now that curse has lost its sting. Now if somebody said, what are you, a women's rights man? It's like, what? But at the time, it was a serious slur meant to emasculate a man who was only a few years out of enslavement himself. And Frederick Douglass demonstrated how to stand up to that kind of baiting. He came out publicly again and again, and he said, I am proud to be known as a women's rights man. And before his death, when he spoke to another conference of women, if I might be allowed to paraphrase, he said, when I ran away from slavery, escaped from slavery, it was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. But when I stood up for women's rights, the question of self was out of the question. And in doing so, I found a little nobility in the act. I believe that's the kind of nobility, the only kind of nobility, to which we should aspire, to be the best fighters against each other's oppression. After the Civil War, when the Democratic and Republican parties tried to tear asunder this powerful coalition by pitting the rights of black men to vote against the rights of white women to vote, Douglass appealed that Lynch law was the law of the land. He appealed to white women to support the right of black men to vote and said he would work as hard as he could to bring about the vote for white women as well. It was the white women who stood with African American liberation who should be on the programming for March Women's History Month and who should be on the coins instead of those like Susan B. Anthony who succumbed to white supremacy in order to defend the right of white women to vote against the right of black men to vote. And when the export of the southern plantations was sent to Cuba and the Philippines and Hawaii, as the expansion of capital, the beginning of this globalization under the cry of free trade, Teddy Roosevelt would exclaim that without war, we will become a nation of effeminate men. The transbaiting that became the birth of Rambo. In Germany in the late 19th and early 20th century, there was a powerful rising movement for gay and trans and lesbian liberation. And it connected with the rise of a women's rights movement as well. And it was a time when there was a powerful workers' movement with socialist leadership and Workers were electing socialists to parliament, and everyone knew World War I was coming. It wasn't a surprise. It was like when the U.S. media was saying, oh, you know, the invasion of Iraq is going to be in February, now the 15th, now the 20th. No, it's going to be March. But when the war began, those who were in parliament caved in and voted for the war credits. And so did many who were the leadership of the German homosexual emancipation movement. The notable exceptions were Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. And it derailed the movement. You know, you could almost imagine the leaders saying, well, gee, it's not really a gay issue, you know. And we're making such headway with the population, and we don't want to appear to be unpatriotic, you know. Can't we just go along with this war? Can't we just sit it out? Well, no, of course not. Because it meant that patriotism, social chauvinism, racism, jingoism began to roll like tank treads over the population. Those who were the most reactionary began to sit taller in the saddle, and those who were the most progressive or revolutionary began to be more isolated and pushed aside. War is a defining moment for any movement. If we can't stand up to a racist colonial war for empire, then what will our movements be able to stand up for? It wasn't until the 1917 Russian Revolution, which within weeks abolished the anti-homosexual laws and extended political and economic and social rights for women, that a new wind began to fill the sails of the movement in Germany as well with new leadership. And in November 1918, during the brief German Revolution, while the bullets were still whizzing overhead, the young revolution gave one of its first gifts to the German homosexual emancipation movement. Prince Hatzfeld's seized mansion, which was handed over to be the new archives of the sexual movement, liberation movement, and became maybe what we could call one of the first lesbian, gay, and trans community centers. And I know I'm leaving out bisexual, but it's because I specifically cannot find that inclusion, but it doesn't mean it did not exist, and I'm still looking. In the U.S., there are many who have heard, of course, about second wave feminism. You may think that all women, and particularly young women, have, but that's not true. If they have heard about it, they've heard the Rush Limbaugh attack on feminism as feminazis. Vicious. They've heard that they were the gender police. Or George Bush Sr.'s ghostwriter's formulation about political correctness, which the right wing has embraced, saying, why can't we just be so openly racist and male chauvinist pigs and always have to be looking over our shoulder nowadays? Why do we have to be so politically correct? Some have heard about the homophile movement at the height of McCarthyism in the 1950s in the US. And if you just read about the homophile movement, you would think, how did it stand up to McCarthyism? How did it happen in the middle of what was the most reactionary period in US history towards lesbians and gay men? A specific campaign in which not only anti-communist red baiting, but lavender menace gay baiting and mass purges from employment were at a frenzy. They looked to the establishment, to the experts, to say, tell us how to just fit in. Tell us how to adjust to oppression. Tell us how not to stand out. They had dress codes. They divorced themselves, quite literally, from the bar crowd, from those who were too butch if they were female and too femme if they were male. How did they do it? How did they organize in the middle of the 1950s? It was a time of a raging witch hunt because the U.S. rulers were enraged about having so-called lost China to a revolution. And the Korean War was underway. And if you spoke out about anything progressive, you could expect to find your name and address in the newspaper, be hounded, lose your job, have to move, have to go underground. It was a time after the war, the burgeoning war industry, which had drawn more women and more African Americans into big industry, and now suddenly Rosie the Riveter was being sent home where father knew best. But what has been left like a gap in collective consciousness, in social memory, because of the excising of the official histories of that period, is the tumultuous and militant struggles that were going on that objectively lifted up even the most moderate demands. For example, how many people here know that between 1950 and 1953, the first gay organizing on a political basis, publicly, based on the West Coast, was led by communist gays? One hand, two and three, four, out of all the people who are here. And that they went out to the gay beaches on the West Coast and got petitions signed to support the Korean people against the Pentagon War, and that they tried to link up the struggle in solidarity with African Americans, with Latinos, and the struggle against anti-Semitism. Daughters of Bilitis, the first national political lesbian rights organization, certainly not the first organizing of lesbians. No voices could have been lifted sweeter or clearer than those of the Harlem Renaissance. And the buffet parties and the rent parties were just as much political organizing and economic organizing. But this was on a national basis. It was largely white women, white collar, professional, middle class for the most part,